Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate and always respectfully. Today, I'm going to be talking with Emily Pinkney. You'll learn a lot more about who she is here in just a moment, but I'll just have to say that she is one of the strong and passionate voices in Pierce County and the South Puget Sound and elsewhere for both creating a better future for ourselves and our grandchildren as far as the climate is concerned, and also the co-related and integrally important issue of climate justice. I'll have show notes for today's program. There's a lot in there to unpack and references to check. Those show notes will be on the ccltacoma.org website. I'll make reference to them at the end of the show. So let's get going and find out what's up with Emily. So today we're talking to Emily Pinkney. She's a marine biologist and an environmental justice activist. She has degrees from Humboldt State University and Duke University. She's also associated with one of my favorite places, the Point Defiance Zoo and Aquarium, where she's the youth coordinator. She's on the Washington State Environmental Justice Task Force, and she's on the Sustainable Tacoma Commission. She's associated with a group called 500 Women Scientists. Maybe we can learn more of that downstream here. She's also associated with the South Sound Urban League Young Professionals. I recently listened to your presentation at Ocean Fest, Emily. I enjoyed it, learned a lot, got a lot out of it, and that's what prompted me to contact you to see if we could talk together on Climate Talk today. So you have quite a resume, and it indicates a lot of passion for your fields of marine biology and environmental justice. So go over for us, if you would, how this passion developed in your life.
So I love the ocean. And I think it started really when I was young. When I moved to America, I was around 2.5, 3 years old. My dad was stationed here from the military. And my mom was actually German. She's from Germany. She's from Schwarzwald, also known as the Black Forest, where she grew up around trees, going to the lake every single summer, and just spending most of her time outdoors. And then my dad, he actually grew up in the Bronx. And what a lot of folks don't know is that, you know, especially pre-EPA era Bronx, it's highly polluted and toxic Superfund sites all over the South Bronx area. And so for him, he never had the opportunity to be in beautiful green spaces, didn't really get the opportunity to ever see the ocean. And so for both my parents, being over here was a dream. I started to fall in love with the Salish Sea area. Even when I was growing up, if we didn't have the most money, outdoors and the environment were free to enjoy for everyone. And I used to spend all of my summers down at Titlow Beach. And when I was about 5 years old, I remember going down there and seeing some sea stars and saying, oh my gosh, I love this so much. I want to work with the animals. And then by the time I was 10 years old, I knew I was going to go to school for marine biology. That's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And so when I did end up going to university to do marine biology, I realized that in my classes, a lot of them, I was the only Black woman. And even in my research courses, which got even smaller, and when I used to do independent research after school, I was the only Black woman. There were other folks of color that I met from different places in the world, which was absolutely fascinating and amazing to meet all these new diverse folks. But it was hard for me to understand why Black people, Black Americans, weren't in any of these spaces, especially STEM spaces, because my classes didn't start with marine biology. They started with biology and then chemistry and then all these other sciences. And so I started to put more of my life's effort and work into making sure that they're inclusive spaces, because there's a lot of systemic barriers and inequities that keep from, you know, the environmental movement and marine biology from being inclusive.
So a really interesting topic here, one I hadn't really anticipated, but I can't help myself. There are so many things in life that on the surface of them may seem subtle, but I've come to realize that a lot of those things that are sort of seemingly subtle really aren't anywhere near so subtle in their impact. So if you wouldn't mind, let's dig in just a little bit more to your experience as a Black student. Tell us a little bit about what your experience was in that regard. I hear the part that, well, you were sort of all by yourself as a Black student, but what was that like? What did that feel like? How did attitudes amongst your professors and fellow students show up?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to be real, I guess it starts in grade school. It starts in grade school for all of us, and starting grade school for me, I was always really inquisitive, and I remember when I was young being told that I'm talking too much and disruptive in classes. And then in second grade, I remember if it wasn't for my parents being the PTA parents that they were, I don't know where I would be. And I think about all the other youth that have these similar experiences. When I was in second grade, I remember the teacher actually suggested, because I was behind on my reading, that I should be in special education classes. I took a math test, and then they put me in a highly gifted program. And that was because my parents advocated for that. So just to give you an idea of some of the barriers and where they start, I really loved math and I love science. And now I really love reading and writing. But at the time, I didn't have the support that I needed. And that's exactly what it was like in college. But the difference is my parents weren't there. So I didn't have those advocates. I didn't have my support system. And I decided, you know, I'm going to move a couple states away, because as much as I love my parents, I wanted to grow up. I wanted to see what it was like to be on my own. And I mean, Northern California, between the Redwoods and the Pacific Ocean, it was hard to get me to leave. So going down there and doing research was, you know, it was my dream. And so when I was finally down there, in classes, very excited for the work, I, you know, even being in some research classes and doing laboratory work, realizing that lab partners, I wasn't necessarily always the first one to get chosen. And this was like, you know, day one of class, you choose your lab partners. People don't know me, but people weren't coming and sitting next to me to be my partner. And then when I did ask for support from some professors, again, this is all about advocates and mentors. And this is really how you keep things inclusive and make them more inclusive, and how to support students from diverse backgrounds, is even if you are somebody who is white or in a position of power and privilege, using your influence to help mentor or advise those underrepresented folks are so important for inclusion. I had teachers and professors tell me, maybe this isn't for me. You know, maybe you don't want to do science. I was struggling in my evolution class, evolution actually being, I think, one of the most fascinating subjects on the planet, and something that I really love to talk about and something I'm fascinated by. And I like to do a lot of research around it. I was told that, you know, maybe I wouldn't make it. And then I remember my freshman year, I also do other stuff. I was a dancer and I played rugby. And I remember getting a concussion right before one of my oceanography midterms. And I wasn't able to reschedule that midterm. And it brought my A down to like a B minus in the class, even though the lab grade for that class maintained an A. I remember asking for a recommendation from that specific professor, and he wrote me a wall of text email about why he couldn't do that because of my grade in the class and all these other things. Later, I had other advisors and professors write recommendation letters for me. And based on my writing and my interest in research, I actually got into all the programs that I applied for, despite that professor not writing me a recommendation letter. And so it's really interesting, because you really can pick and choose who you support. But if someone's interested in something, wants to be a part of something, there's no reason to not pull them along with you. They just may have a different type of expertise or a different type of learning. And especially in academics, academics is one of the worst places where white supremacy is harbored. And we say that this is professionalism, that, you know, this is academics, but in reality, it's an elitism that keeps out folks who are from BIPOC communities or low income.
Yeah, the subject of mentorship is so important. And so unhappy, sad, I guess I would say, that sometimes, maybe often, mentorship is based on things other than the desire or the willingness or the passion or the intelligence that somebody brings to the table. Just a preconception of where people fit in. Does that sound like I'm getting it a little bit?
I mean, yeah. So it's exactly like that. And it's also, there's, because I work with youth now, especially working with young BIPOC folks, it's easier for me. And it's easier for me, one, because I'm a lot younger than a lot of the mentors that we have in some of these spaces, but also because I'm a woman of color doing it. a lot of mentors and support systems that I had were actually white folks, but that's because they also tried to understand where I was coming from. And they also did a lot of this diversity, equity, and inclusion work, meaning that they read up the history of science being racist. They would look up things around the environment and systemic barriers. They were conscious of those things and also open and continuing to learn and be aware about things going on that maybe they didn't understand their whole lives. And that was something that was very much a struggle for me. I think nowadays it's becoming more prevalent. We're having more conversations and people are starting to humble themselves a little bit more about the things that we haven't known our whole lives or didn't understand.
Yeah, absolutely. So this kind of branches off into an area that I'm really personally interested in and anxious to get your perspective on this. Now, I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. I do lots of stuff. I do presentations. I've taught a continuing education course at TCC. We have this radio program and so on and so forth. Now, the fact of the matter is that the audiences that I speak to and that I interact with and the activists at Citizens Climate Lobby, pretty much exclusively middle-class white people. And we have conversations about how to become more diverse, how to reach out. But the fact of the matter is, I just don't think we really know how to do it for the most part. So could you speak to that okay, so maybe you could mentor me a little bit on this one. Let's approach it from that perspective.
Yeah, and I mean, and that is it right there. That's exactly what it looks like. Say, you know, coming to the door and saying, we are willing and able and ready to learn. There's a couple different steps, especially with like traditionally white organizations that I think are really important to take. And the first one is really starting to become aware and do the education and do the work. Actually, you know, one of my colleagues and friends, Tamar Jackson, a couple of days, you know, he's, you know, a prominent person around social justice in the city of Tacoma. And we were talking about, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion work. And he says, I don't want you to come to me and ask me for book recommendations on what to read around anti-racism. I want you to come with me with a chapter in a book that you would like to discuss that you've been reading about anti-racism. Those are the questions I can answer. And I think there's a lot of work that comes with being a Black person in America. There's a lot of work that comes with being any person of color on the planet. You have to, I mean, I always tell people every single day I'm reminded that I'm Black. Somebody tells me, and it's always subtle. Sometimes it's through a microaggression. Sometimes it's when I'm at the grocery store. Sometimes it's through a work email. There's always so many ways that white supremacy can show itself. And so because we go through that, we have to work at not losing it every day. We have to work at not being upset with the world for the situation that we're in. So we work hard and we're resilient and we fight, but we shouldn't have to be. We shouldn't have to learn lessons in that way. And so those are the things that we need white folks to learn before coming to us. And then humbling themselves around the fact that, like, I sit in this power and privilege, and I've sat in it for a long time, and I maybe haven't used it as effectively to make sure that there's equal human rights for everyone. And like sitting in that and really feeling that and letting that emotion go over you is so valuable and important to even moving forward to the next steps. Because then the next steps is reaching out. And reaching out is one of the hardest things to do because mistakes get made and people can sometimes get hurt. You have to come into it with being okay with discomfort, because discomfort means that you're growing. Anytime you're a little bit uncomfortable, that means that you're growing a little bit more. You're learning more. So when you go up to an organization of color, or say that you go, for instance, to tribal leaders and you say, you know, we're doing this environmental work and we want to be able to work with your community. We want to have you a part of what we're doing in our movement. The first thing you have to do is when you say that is say, well, what are your movements and what are you doing? How can we support you? How do we show up for you? So the next time that Manny Ellis, who gets slain in the streets of Tacoma, your organization has to show up and say, so how do we show up for you? Because if you show up for our community, we'll show up for you. We will always show up. Any climate march will be there. But we need white folks to use their power and privilege for us. Because we can't even start to talk about limiting fossil fuels if we can't even walk down the street without, you know, dealing with things like police brutality or just everyday racism. And so those are the ways to start creating that relationship, because it's about relationships, right? because we're all part of the same human family. But the problem is not everyone's needs are being met, and not everyone is having equal opportunity to resources right now, especially with coronavirus. And I mean, it's a respiratory illness, and our air is unclean. We still are sitting in the smoking air right now. And there's people who are living on the streets, a lot of folks of color living on the streets. We need to talk about homelessness. You know, we need to talk about healthcare, because sometimes when especially white-led environmental organizations start talking about climate change, they're not talking about the human element. At the end of the day, conservation is not an animal or a plant issue. It's a human issue. It's something we need to work on. We need to work on our conservation behavior change. But our conservation behavior change that we have is honestly, I mean, a lot of the things that we do, especially when it comes around fossil fuels, it's a weaponized tool of racism as well. Putting a power plant, you know, in a neighborhood is usually in a Black neighborhood. So if you work with those folks from that community and say, I want to make sure that you have good healthcare, I want to make sure you have access to clean air, then they will be a part of your organization and work on your work.
Yeah, so, well, thanks for that. And I just want to kind of recap my understanding a little bit and make sure that I'm kind of getting it. So we start off by doing our homework as privileged white people in middle-class organizations to actually develop a better understanding of what it's like to be a person of color in our society. I mean, you sketched out some of the things that you deal with hour by hour every day as kind of an example of what we're talking about. And then after having done the research, it perhaps begins to be time for some reaching out. And one of the things that I heard you say there, which I think is really important, I would take it as important, is in reaching out, I personally have to be prepared to make mistakes, to say something that offends somebody, to not understand, to be rejected. God, I hate to be rejected. Then to offer offer ourselves as a resource rather than, let's say, somebody who's writing in to rescue. How am I doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're hitting the nail on the head. And the one thing too about the rejection, and what I always remind people, is that that one moment of rejection doesn't equal up to the amount of trauma that that person that you're working with might have. Because I've had it too. I mean, there's many communities that I do not represent that I also like to support. Like, for instance, the tribal community. You know, I just spoke with one of my friends who is, you know, a leader in the Puyallup tribe. And I said, I have more learning to do. I have so much more learning to do. And I need to make sure that I'm there for you. I was like, here are the resources I had. I like laid them out on the table. Like, literally, I was like, I'm part of this group. I have this type of influence, because every human has a sphere of influence. And I said, which parts of influence do you want? What do you want from me? Because I want to make sure that you have what you need. And I mean, the important thing for all of us too is one of my favorite community agreements is assuming positive intentions, but acknowledging impact. So even if your intentions are good, we still have to acknowledge that impact, you know, even just having a conversation with someone, you have no idea what they've gone through today. And especially being a Black person, every day is a circus. I feel like, you know, watching what's going on in the Breonna Taylor case, I had a whole day of work where I told my boss, I said, I apologize in advance, but this is the energy that I have. And I just need you to know that, because I know that you're from a different community and it may not hit you the same way. And so sometimes you might try to ask somebody for their support or talk to them 5 minutes after they've just seen someone else slain on TV, because there's going to be more. It's going to happen again. Black people, we already know that. And we're just devastated every time it happens. So we really need our allies to help us and fight that. You know, we're all part of either an agent identity group or a target identity group. And some of us are part of both. Like, I'm one of those. An agent is someone who can be an agent of oppression or an agent of change. And having an agent group, for instance, I'm able-bodied. I'm young. I'm also, even though I am Black, I'm also light-skinned, and there's a privilege there as well. And so those are my agent identities, where I can be an agent of change, but I can also oppress using those identities if I wanted to, because that's the privilege that I have. And then I also have a target identity. I'm a Black woman. And that is something that, because I have that target identity, it does give me a lot of setbacks and barriers in life. But there's different ways to navigate between those. And like I said, we need to be okay with being uncomfortable, because that means that we're able to grow.
Yeah, I get the uncomfortable piece for sure, because I've noted in myself for some time now that as I ponder these issues from my white privilege perspective, that there absolutely is discomfort. Part of the discomfort for me is to realize that historically I've had some ideas and some attitudes and perspectives that weren't accurate, that were hurtful to other people, and that's a difficult thing for me anyway to accept, and thus the discomfort. So you've said so much in the last 5 minutes, and I think it's really important. And I just want to remind listeners that these programs are in the archive. So if you need to hear the last 5 minutes or anything else in this program, it is going to be in the archive. So you can go to the KTEH website and listen and absorb, because as I said, so much to understand in what you said just recently. I would like to change direction just a little bit, if you're all right with that.
Yeah.
And so what I would like to look at is what specifically are some of the issues regarding climate change that particularly impact communities of color?
Yeah, everything. Everything that's impacting everyone in the world. Do that times a bajillion. And that's what's impacting communities of color. It's hard. It sucks to look at our demographic data and see that, you know, specifically. So, for instance, working with the Environmental Justice Task Force, I work with the Environmental Health Disparities Map. That map gives us an idea of the communities that need the most help and focus currently in solving environmental issues. And that map is something that we're asking agencies to look at when making decisions that we know will impact the environment in those places. That map shows that all these communities where you have, you know, large sections of immigrant populations, people who, you know, their second language is English, Black folks, historical Black communities, that all of those areas are higher up on, you know, these different pollution data points, whether that's high PM levels or whether that's, you know, having toxic air quality, low birth weight for infants, high infant mortality rate. All of those are in these communities of color. And those are all symptoms of a deeper problem. And that deeper problem is racism. Racism really does drive climate change in a way that seems indirect, but it's very intentional in certain places. Like, you know, there's a reason that the LNG plant is in Tacoma is located where it's at. And that's because that's where the port is. In the port, the particular activities and groups that are in that area are on Puyallup tribal land. The Puyallup tribe is located right there, and there's communities of color that live right there that are being directly poisoned. There's a Chinook landing that, you know, Chinook salmon are a tribal resource, and tribal resources under law are protected, but they're right across from that LNG plant. For instance, right now, housing is a huge issue. Housing is, like I said, I mean, when there's smoke outside, they are telling you to stay inside because the air is too hazardous to breathe. I spent the entire week, that 2 weeks ago when it was really smoky, I threw up twice that week. I was so sick from the smoke. And I said, I am so lucky that I get to be inside. So you don't even have a chance if you're laying outside to these climate things that are happening, because the climate is just getting worse. Our summers are getting hotter. Our rainy season is going to get a lot more worse, which is going to make things worse, not just for the people, but also for the animals, also for the environment. Thinking about things like our orca whales, storm drain runoff, when our rain events get worse and there's more pollution in the street that goes straight into our water. So when it comes to thinking about these issues, they're all actually really intersectional. I think as humans, we really want to be able to categorize things and say, you know, this is a housing issue, this is a health issue, this is an employment issue. But where we work, where we play, and where we live is all deeply connected to our sense of place and where we are in the environment. When I worked with the Seattle Aquarium, I realized I was so exhausted because I had to get up earlier to go to work. I realized that at the time I didn't have a car, so I was taking the bus. So I had to wake up at these ungodly hours to walk all the way to Pacific Avenue from MLK Junior Way at 5 a.m. to go start my shift at the aquarium at 9 a.m. And I take that bus all the way to Seattle. That's a transportation justice issue. I should be able to have transit that's faster, where I don't have to be that far away from where I work. It's also a housing justice issue. I couldn't afford to live in a city like Seattle. Not that I really want to. I love Tacoma, but it would be closer to my job. So all of these things are connected. And because I have to take that bus and, you know, that bus, it's not like it's a hybrid bus. It's not like it's electrified. So that means that those PM emissions are going up and down that I-5 corridor. Guess who lives by the corridor? Communities of color.
So one of the things I'm picking up from that description, that part of the conversation, mm-hmm. is that in a very, so one of the things that's really common amongst a lot of folks is just either outright denial of climate change or mm-hmm. sort of a head in the sand approach to climate change. But part of the reason for that is I'm picking up from what you've just sketched out is that many of us get to escape on a daily basis so many of the contributors to climate change.
Yes. And that's exactly what power and privilege looks like. You know, it was funny because I just watched a video about folks talking about colonizing Mars because Earth is becoming unlivable. And I said, are you kidding me? Why are we still colonizing places? That's what started all of this mess. We colonized our land and exploited it. We took it from people who had lived on this land and understood how the land worked. I mean, think about it. You know, when you go to another country for vacation, you say, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You know, if the locals eat this food, they live this lifestyle, why not do what people who have been living here for centuries and their ancestors have taught them to do? Why not follow that example? Instead, we came over here on big boats, stole people from another country and then stole the land and said, you know what, we're going to use the land in this way, not knowing for, you know, eons that indigenous communities already use the land in the type of way that was it was give and take. There was a reciprocation between the land and the people, knowing that this is how we sustain life forever. You know, we're not thinking of forever. We're thinking about right now, and we're thinking about ourselves.
Yeah, you know, I think that is such a key issue. I just recently spent a few days hiking over on the Olympic Peninsula in some forest that I guess I would call semi-primitive, some signs of logging in the past, but still beautiful forests. And to realize that the Indians lived in this world for thousands of years and lived in it with harmony, and we've come in and basically created a mess out of it in just a couple 300 years, and it's a sad thing to be aware of. And there are lessons that we can take as the majority society about how that sustainable lifestyle was able to exist for thousands of years, and compare it side by side with the kind of devastation, really just devastation, that we're creating as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you
know, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to just say, you know, the concept of thinking about, you know, the United States of America and how long that we've been living the way that we have, you know, and what it looked like before. Like, we had these massive, beautiful forests, hearing Lewis and Clark and reading their stories about when, you know, they came over to Washington State and how beautiful and gorgeous it was. You know, that's what made people want to come to this place, you know, and start a new life. And in doing so, didn't listen to the land and didn't listen to the people who already lived on that land, and instead took their lives and took their resources. When in reality, if we had listened to them, we wouldn't be in this problem that we're in. We have really quickly accelerated the rate at which the planet is dying. And we've done that because we haven't been empathetic, and we haven't been listening for understanding to the original stewards of the land.
Yep, that's so true, and such sound advice. So let's talk a little bit more from your perspective. Put on your marine biologist hat. You've made a couple references to the Salish Sea. By the way, mm-hmm. My office overlooks the Tacoma Narrows, and I can see the Olympic Mountains from mm-hmm. my office. And I got to say, I am just in love with this land and so admiring of the Salish Sea. And it's also painful to know that we're not taking anywhere near the kind of care that we should of the Salish Sea. And I include up into British Columbia because I've explored those waters a lot up mm-hmm. there too. So give us a rundown on what your perspective is as a marine biologist on the state of the Salish Sea, what we're doing that we shouldn't be doing, and what we should be doing.
Yeah, so it's hard because I feel like I have so many thoughts. I feel like there's days where I have so much hope, and then there's days where I'm like, oh my gosh, shake my head, what are we doing? But I will say, I have places of hope, especially with all the the orcas being pregnant. You know, the southern resident killer whale. What I always remind people is they are the most polluted marine mammal on the planet because of storm drain runoff. We live on a hillless place, and every single time we have rain events. And so every single time we have rain events, it goes straight into their water, straight to where their food sources are. But like I said, seeing that there's some pregnant and that there's a new baby, this gives me a lot of hope. And I always tell people, I parallel kind of like how you talked about how people don't believe in climate change. It's kind of in the same way that I feel like they don't believe in racism. And I feel like I parallel the hope that I feel with these orcas with the hope that I feel that people are waking up and learning, because I think that they're waking up and learning that we can't continue to let our planet die in this way. And the way in which it's dying, it's not, again, it's not just killing the plants and the animals, it's going to kill us too. I think that right now there's a lot of energy, especially with Environmental Justice Task Force and the Environmental Justice Working Group we have here in Tacoma that's just starting up through Sustainable Tacoma Commission and the city. I think that with those voices coming to the table, we can have some really important perspectives on what the solutions actually are. Because like I've said, like we've had so many symptomatic solutions. And as much as we can ban all, using plastic straws, we need to ban, plastic production. And those plastic production companies are in communities of color. With Environmental Justice Task Force, we've made so much groundwork, even though our task force time for this year and our recommendations is technically coming to a close. This is just the beginning. We will be proposing the HEAL Act one more time in this next legislative session. And what my hope is that with the new voices that are at the table, that we can make some real important policy, because it all starts with education and policy. Mm-hmm. The reason people don't believe things, the reason people don't see things, is because they just don't have the knowledge or education behind it. But that doesn't mean they don't care. And that doesn't mean that it's not impacting them directly. And so making sure we have that, and then making sure that we have policy to protect people and the environment, and not to spread burdens, but to reduce the burdens. Because what it is right now is we have certain communities that have the most environmental benefits and some that have the most environmental burdens. What we really need to do though is eliminate all those burdens together. And those burdens are things like fossil fuels. Using fossil fuels seems so ridiculous to me. I can't believe we're still using them, especially with alternative resources. I remember when I was a kid, my mother is German. Germany uses a lot of alternative resources. In Germany, if you want to have solar panels on your house, they'll ask you, the government will come out, put the solar panels on your house for free. They're on your home. And then once you start producing energy, they will actually buy it back from you, which is only a gain to people. We need to start thinking of programs that are more incentivizing to the community. Because if the community is incentivized, they'll be more likely to engage in conservation behavior change. But the problem is that we just don't have strong enough policy for that at the moment.
Yeah, and so strong policies makes me think of the coming election, which we don't have time to talk about today, but so important that everybody do their homework and support candidates who are aware of what's going on in the environment, and not only aware, but willing to do something about it too. Mm-hmm. So Emily, we're getting close to the end here. So I would just like to finish up by asking you, are there areas that we could have talked about today that we haven't that you'd like to bring up?
Yeah. I mean, before I go off, just kind of a little bit back to the mentoring space, but just to highlight, youth, they're the ones who are going to be making the decisions. And as someone who's now 27, who's been working on this, I've been working in social justice since I was about 15. I've always loved the environment, but really focused on environmental justice. You know, when I was 18 through 21, really didn't get any support. People didn't take me seriously because at the time I wasn't degreed yet. And education is a privilege. And so making sure that we amplify the voices of all of those who are unheard, and youth is part of that group as well. There's a lot of youth leaders out there, and a lot of youth leaders who've been doing this long before Greta Thunberg. Her voice is powerful, but there's so many youth who've been out here, who are continually out here, who want to be involved. That is the way that you can get a diverse organization. especially because they have so much energy, but making sure that you don't exploit that energy, making sure that when they do give all that love and passion for the environment, making sure that you help mentor them, help them with their resume, help them with their CV, help them go to college, help them with housing, making sure that we assist our youth to be able to have generational wealth, as well as the tools and resources to be able to fight this climate fight. Because like I said, I'm 27, I'm young still, but I know just like my parents, I'm going to get tired too. And so making sure that we can help support them, I think, is one of the most important things we can do right now. Because I always remind people, you know, we've been yelling and screaming about climate for a minute, and it took a couple of youth climate strikes for the world to really say, okay, let's have a serious conversation about this.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. And it's something that I'm going to encourage my own organization to give more energy to, because I really see that the future of this is so dependent. By this, I'm talking about the environment in general and climate in particular. Mm-hmm. It's so much dependent upon the energy that the youth bring to it, and it's our job to give them the resources to put that energy to work and mm-hmm. create a better future. They're the ones who are going to live with the future, and so it's appropriate in that regard. Well, Emily, I really appreciate you being with us today. I've learned a lot. Are there any particular books or publications that you would recommend to, let's say, white middle-class people who want to become more aware, more sensitive of racial issues and so on? What could you recommend in that regard?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I think for a good beginning book, White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. It's written by a white woman, so it's easy. And then something a little more critical and a little more intense, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. That's Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. And it talks about some of the actions and behaviors that you'll see displayed in Black communities today that might not make sense. Like behaviors where, like, how we treat one another, or, you know, how even facing certain inequities, you'll see certain Black folks be able to rise up through that and become resilient, and see some other communities still oppressed, even when you try to lend help. That talks about the epigenetics of trauma and how that continues on. And then just something for fun and for representation, Black and Brown Faces in Wildlife Spaces. I really like that book. It's a picture book as well as just stories of just Black people enjoying nature, out at Yellowstone, out at the ocean, just being humans, enjoying the planet. It's really feel good, and representation matters.
That's awesome. Well, I appreciate those recommendations. We have a book club in my Citizens Climate Lobby group, and we'll be putting those books on our list of books to read and talk about and learn from. So once again, Emily, thank you so much for being here. I got to say, I'm deeply admiring of your energy, your passion, your love for the world, and really, I think I pick up in there deep love and respect for your fellow human beings as well.
Yeah, thank you so much, John. I really appreciate it. I'm really privileged to be on this show today, and I'm excited to hear it.
Okay, take care.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Well, what a pleasure to have had Emily with us today, and what a powerful voice she is, calling us to increased awareness and consciousness. I will have references available at the tcctacoma.org website. Just go there, look for the Climate Talk logo, click on that, and it'll take you right to those resources. I would love to hear from you. You can contact me at John, J-O-H-N, at cctacoma.org. And so, as always, for now, I'm reminding you to live like the mountain's out. Take care.